Are we recording? No, too much.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ducks Watch Together. I'm Josh.
I'm Kylie.
And I'm Ian.
And on today's episode, we continue talking about Steven Spielberg's films ranked, part two.
Ugh.
Why an ugh?
We're now in just like the middle tier here.
Not bad, but not great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great, so it's going to be a whole episode of like, meh, meh, meh.
Actually, I think that his middle tier is still pretty good.
I think will be a bit of a...
Oh, so it'll be like, I think it's meh. Well, I think it's meh, meh.
Exactly.
Good, great, that's going to be the whole thing. And from this point out, we'll just speak in meh. Meh, 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 the meh, meh of the meh, 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 meh.
I have to live with this all the time.
That's why we go and hang out. That's why we sometimes have our lady dates.
Meh, 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 meh.
I'm still on the back page of this list. I don't even get to flip to the front for a little bit.
Meh,
the highest we've gotten on my list is 15 because I still have a child love for Temple of Doom.
Meh, 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 meh.
You're fired. Okay, I'm just gonna, should we just jump in?
Let's jump in.
No, we need the question of the week, Kylie!
Wait, okay, what is it?
The question of the week is, which is a ridiculous one.
What is the most middle film of Spielberg?
That is exactly the question of the week! Which film is the most middlest?
Your wife left.
She did, she's done with me.
All right, well, do you know where you guys can answer that? You can answer it on our Facebook page, Friend of a Friend Podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a 5-star review and tell us the answer to our question. We would love to see you there.
Yep, agreed.
All right, let's just jump in. Just dive head first.
I'm ready.
I think we need to recap a little bit of the Spielbergian tropes that we talked about on the last episode. Here we go. Here's another 45 minutes.
I'll just copy and paste that right now. If you're now just joining us and you want to know what those Spielbergian tropes are, go check out the episode before this where the first minutes are about that.
I don't think we should describe them as tropes, per se. I think they might be more like his...
Flavors.
Flavors is a good word. I like his techniques. Or his...
That's such a boring word when you compare it to flavors.
Ooh, his milieu.
Milieu.
I like his... Milieu.
I like his palate.
Milieu. Like, he tastes it with his tongue?
Milieu.
His palate?
Yeah, he just goes around and tastes his actors.
He licks them!
Yep.
Licking Speedy Babes!
And you know what actor he's licking in this number 20 movie?
Before we get there.
Oh my gosh!
Do you want to recap the last 10?
Do you want me to just read them?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Amistad, War Horse, Indiana Jones, The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, 1941... AI, the Artificial Intelligence. That was 30 through 26. 25 through 21 is War of the Worlds, Always, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and The Sugarland Express.
Nice. That's quite a few. Quite a few films there. It might actually be 10. Just 10. 10 exactly. Alright, Kylie, I don't know why you've been stalling. Number 20.
This is really where my questioning was, is it better or worse than this film?
Ooh, there was a line created.
Yep, and all it was right. At this film. This film is called The Terminal.
Hey, that's my number 20.
It's my number 21.
It's my number 17. Woo, let's dive into The Terminal, you guys.
The Terminal exists on being charming and being a decent enough story with a strong enough main character that we can get behind and we can enjoy watching. But other than that, this film doesn't have much.
If it were not for the fact that Tom Hanks was in this movie, I don't think that this movie would really be worth watching.
So this is one of Spielberg's masterpieces. I think it's a glorious romp through an idea of what it's really like to be inside the mind of a Krakosian citizen. Man, I had to. I messed up the last word.
Yeah.
I was so good that I messed up the last word.
Krakosia.
I got Krakosia, but citizen.
It's not a real country, so I don't really care.
Well, I mean, it's not that I don't care because it's not a real
I care
city.
About Tom Hanks as a human
yeah,
being.
Yeah, because Tom Hanks is real, because Tom Hanks is just so gosh darn charming and adorable in this movie, and this whole time you're watching, you do want this character to succeed okay. and to...
You care about Tom Hanks.
Yes.
But do you care about Victor Navorsky?
I do care about Victor Navorsky.
Right?
Yeah.
Because he's such a good guy. He's so cool. Goat! Say goat! You just need to say goat.
Just say goat.
Say goat!
Oh, man.
There
just
doesn't
like that one scene.
Seem to be a point to this movie. Like, a strong, like, this is the message that the movie is saying, other than it's a cute story. And it's about being a cool, good person.
You should also like women, even if they're not 29, you know?
Somehow Spielberg ends up making a pretty middle-of-the-road film. And I think that while there are elements of The Terminal that work, including Hanks' performance, and I think in general, if the film would have been... Like, half this film works and half this film doesn't. And if it would have just focused on the part that worked and the interesting ideas of what it would be a man without a country and what it would be to be trapped in this terminal, and those are heavy things, but you can do it in a lighthearted way. I think it's really clear that you can do it in a lighthearted way, and it's shown in this film. But where it does bog down is anything to do with the Catherine Zeta-Jones character and the Diego Luna character. And while Catherine Zeta-Jones, I would give some of the blame, Diego Luna is just an actor playing a part. And I think he actually did well enough with that role. In that sense of, if I didn't have a brain, and I wasn't, like, really trying to be like, what's happening? You're falling in love with this woman who you never talked to? And that...
Even worse! What's happening? You're falling in love with this man who is sending a person up to talk to you for him? What's wrong with you?
So, yes, Diego Luna and Zoe Saldana play those parts well enough. They're not needed, and they're very problematic. Mm-hmm. Catherine Zeta-Jones, however, her character is also problematic, and then for somehow, some way, she just brings it even more down.
Because I'm insane! I'm crazy! I'm sick! I'm sick! Stay away from me, Victor! I'm sick!
Why?
That's her line. Why is she sick? Because, like, she likes men who, I don't know, don't love her, but she likes them because she likes attention. And all I know about this woman is that she's defined by her relationship with other men. And she's 20, she's not 29.
I don't know what she does for a living.
She's a stewardess.
I don't remember her name.
Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yeah, you don't remember her name either.
The third.
Amelia.
Man, I was gonna say Amelia.
You weren't quick enough.
I was being like, I think it's Amelia.
Amelia Earhart. It was all there.
Oh, was there the whole time.
She gets lost in the sea of her relationships.
Well, so if it would have been something... Because I believe that there's an interesting character to look at there in terms of a woman who defines herself by her relationships is a problem. Mm-hmm. And if this film were to be like, oh man, have her make that realization, be like, oh, I am just defining myself by these men. I am a stronger person than that. I am a stronger woman than that. Victor, I like you, but I don't need to be defined by my liking of you. In some way, shape, or form, I think that the seed of the character would have worked. That doesn't happen. That's too progressive for this film. In general, if you were to cut out the whole romance angle of this and just focus on Tom Hanks, Tri McBride, Diego Luna, Kumar Panala, and Zoe Saldana versus the Tooch, I'm on board.
Well, you can even have Catherine Zeta-Jones' character, but don't make her a romantic interest. Make her a friend who's trying to help him out.
And maybe that would be something that would help define her character better, is if he's not actually romantically interested in her. Mm-hmm. Then she can still define herself by her relationships, and we can see that, or she can learn that not every man wants her for that, and she can have those scenes where she's like, oh my gosh, I'm asking you on a date, I'm so dumb, and he can be like, well, it's fine, just don't ask me out on a date, like, it's alright, it's cool. It's really, it's that bogs it down. And then, so once you get into that story, then you're starting to find out, like, why he went to America in the first place, which is kind of wonky in that sense of...
Oh, so that third act, I don't know what act twist that is, but when we're finally shown what is in the stupid planter's peanuts and it hasn't been set up the whole time, I'm like, hey, Spielberg, why weren't you setting this up before?
Why wasn't there just a bunch of jazz in the airport?
He could have been, like, there could have been jazz or something. He could have been like, oh, jazz, I know this, blah, 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 blah. And then it would have helped to make sense. But it doesn't seem like it's set up at all. And then Spielberg at the end was like, oh, what is in the planter's jar?
Yes.
This is definitely one of his films where it has a clear stopping point and it keeps going. Because in my head, and how I thought it had ended the first time I saw it, I don't know why, I just forgot the last 20 minutes. But in my head, he steps out into New York, looks at it, and the movie ends. Because the whole movie is about him going to New York, mm-hmm. right?
Well, but they set up enough of a point of why he needs to go to New York.
Yeah, but because... I don't need to see it. Personally, I don't need to see it.
I don't know. It's kind of fulfilling to see him get that last name in there.
I think it's frustrating. And especially because
knowing what he wants to do is go home, that to me, I don't mind that he goes out. I just wish it was a stronger reason that he goes out. Because I think what you're responding to is you don't need to see it because you don't care about that picture that his father had in the jar, which has not been set up. Like, even if it was as simple as cliche and simple as it sounds, be like, my father and I loved jazz.
And why is he keeping it a secret?
He's not. People just aren't explicitly... They're like, what's in the planters? And he's like, jazz. And that's all he says. And no one is like, what does that mean? They're not like questioning it any further. They just accept, okay.
Jazz.
Except
and the Tooch never asks him because he wants to use it against him. Because
the Tooch doesn't care.
No, yeah.
I don't think the Tooch even knows what's in that jar. I don't think he knows that
jar. He asked a couple times over. Okay. Yeah, because he thinks that it's like his, like, the key to Dvorsky's downfall.
It's jazz.
It's jazz. But even if there's some simple line in that same scene where he's like, my father and I listen to this album, it means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. That's why I want all these images. Right now, it's just like, my dad did this.
So I'm just going to do it.
His moralistic center of staying in the airport works until that moment, because you're like, you're doing this for just because you want to get the signature for your dad.
Well, I mean, in theory, he can't go anywhere, really.
Right. But like, he could. He's just portrayed as a hyper-moralistic person who would not break the rules.
Right. Like, so his choices are to go out into New York City or to stay in the terminal, because he can't get onto another plane because he doesn't have a passport anymore. And so he can't go anywhere else. So his options are terminal or New York City. And so, he just decides to stay in the terminal.
The Tooch is a jerk.
I wait.
Listen, I think this movie is cute. This movie has a lot of fun moments and scenes in it. Hanks is charming as all get out.
That scene where he finds out that Carcosia is under, like, a civil war, and he's just running around
tears?
And crying.
Tears? Oh.
Man, this is a very, like, I have a tender spot in my heart for this, but, like... Yeah. It's mostly just Tom Hanks in it.
Yeah. And it doesn't see, like, there are some shots that are definitely Spielberg's long take, and there are definitely some stuff in there that feels very Spielbergian. His orange shot, I don't think his orange shot is in this film. It doesn't feel very Spielbergian. It actually feels very small and pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting. That's the thing there. If he doesn't have Hanks and it's not Spielberg, I think this is a blip on the map and nobody ever talks about the terminal ever again.
I mean, it's a 2004 movie, and so maybe he was just looking for something that was a little bit more lighthearted than compared to, like... Because, I mean... This is one of the films that starts getting developed after 9/11.
And in terms of that, if you believe in the 9/11 trilogy that he has, this is the first quote-unquote film in that, meaning this is what a Spielberg pre 9/11 would be. And that kind of makes sense. I mean, imagine this film if it was a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, and it was a kid stuck in the terminal. And I think at that point, this film actually works a lot better. Because a child having to survive through there and doing all these things would be really interesting. Or maybe like a teenager, so that like the job thing can still happen and they're still like, oh, you're on Harry's team or whatnot. Like, put him as a teenager of working age, but still like maybe one who's coming to a new country and gets stuck on this terminal, I think would be fascinating. And like age, I think man, because then we get to see Spielberg dealing with youth and children again, and he plays some of this stuff with... I think I fixed the terminal.
You literally fixed the terminal by taking out the best part of it.
I'm sorry that I did that, but alas, it might be true, because if this is a teenager of some kind, the actions of the film make more sense.
I mean, that's fair. Although, why is Stanley Tucci, like, beating on a little kid? A teenager.
Tucci is just a jerk, okay?
Why is he beating on Tom Hanks? Everybody loves Tom Hanks.
Beating up a teenager and beating up Tom Hanks? Most people feel more sad for Tom Hanks, okay?
It's fair. Say goat.
Kokoja.
It's for your goat.
Kokoja.
It's for his goat.
It's goat.
Say goat.
It's goat.
Say goat. Is it for the goat or the father?
What was the scene in Schindler's List that I compared this to that you guys were glaring at me?
Let's not bring that up.
Because there's a similar scene where, like, he's got to choose between two things, and he just has to get the other person to understand, you have to lie.
Say goat.
Say goat. Hashtag say goat.
I mean, he's basically, it's Ben Kingsley being like, you're a metal worker.
Oh, yeah. You're a metal worker.
You're all metal workers, right?
Say goat.
Say metal worker.
Say metal worker.
Metal worker.
You're a goat. Okay, we're gonna move on from the terminal. 19, Kylie, what is it?
The Adventures of Tintin.
That's my 17.
I had to flip the page. That's my 16.
24! This film's kinda garbage.
I didn't rewatch it. I remember liking it as a kid, but also it didn't, like, it's not super memorable at this point.
Ah, yes, 2011 Kid Anne.
Yeah, sure. I was 17, Kylie.
Yeah, if she was from Kokoja, trapped in an airport, they would have trapped her there. She's a teenager.
Oh my god.
I kind of like The Adventures of Tintin.
Great.
Things that I don't think that work is the animation style of this
one. Not at all!
No.
It is very unsettling to watch from the very get-go.
There are many adventures, and that is pretty much what you expect out of this movie.
Yeah.
It's fine. It exists. It's a thing. If you can get past the animation style, which Spielberg's not necessarily known for pushing technology forward. He's known for pushing the art form forward, but not necessarily technology. And so you can see that this is where his collaboration with Peter Jackson was like, hey, Pete Jackson and I are going to make this progressive mocap film. And Speedy Babes just is out of his element. And there's so many things in here where I was like, are you a live-action film? Are you an animated film? I don't really think you know what you are, nor do I think that you know what you want to be, and therefore I think it hurts this film a lot. It's dull. Like, there's a lot of action beats that I guess should work, but I don't care about Tintin. I don't care about the captain. I don't care about the villain. I don't care. And part of that is that giant brick wall of that animation style, which is so hard to watch. And I love animation. And to me, I think you don't necessarily have to have a great... I mean, yes, I prefer great animation. But if your story holds through, I'll forgive some flaws, much with anything else. And this just was fun, but it wasn't needed in this format. And I don't know. It exists.
I had fun with it.
Great.
I really like that scene, that one long scene where they're chasing the bird and trying to get the three things back together. I enjoy that entire scene, just like how long it is, mm-hmm. and how, like, I think that that's a really well done one. It takes place, quotes, in one shot, so there's no cuts in between it, and I can really appreciate that. And I mean, I definitely agree with Andy Serkis's character of not being a very enjoyable one.
He's a belligerent, drunk ship captain who's supposed to carry half of a children's film.
Yeah, I was watching this and I was like, ooh, where?
I would say that this film is probably more appropriate for, like, 14 and up.
But it's not aimed at them.
I know.
The humor of this is not aimed at them. Like, if you want to enjoy this at 14 and up, you have to enjoy it as a child first. I think that part of this is it still has 1930s value, because that's when Tintin was big, like, was made, and so it's got a 14-year-old reporter without parents running around with a gun with a belligerent ship captain who's his best friend somehow. Like,
I watched the cartoon, and I still...
He's 14?
Yeah, Tintin is 14!
Oh, no, because I was looking at it with the eyes of he's, like, maybe 16 or 18.
I mean... Okay, 16 is the same thing. 16 is the same thing.
You know what we do to 16-year-olds? We give them a piece of paper that says you can get... Sorry, it's plastic. You can get into a car and possibly harm yourself. But you're pretty good at driving. We give
if
them,
you have enough hours.
We give them a permit for a death machine, essentially. So...
I think you were saying something before Kylie caught my age.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I was saying I've watched the cartoon a little bit, and I don't remember the drunk ship captain at all. Perhaps he was not in the specific episodes that I've watched. But
Haneker is
it also might not have been as apparent of a thing, because, yeah, it's Haneker or Hardnick.
No, I think he just, like, teams up with Haddock. Him every once Haddock. In a while.
Haddock is a big part, so I've read some of the Tintin comics, mm-hmm. and Haddock is a big part of the Tintin comics.
Okay.
He's a regular in and out of the comics, but, I mean, he is essentially the Doc Brown to Tintin's Marty. Like,
and I think that, I mean, this movie tries to give him, like, a redeeming, like, they have to show him at his bottom because they're trying to show that scene where he chooses the slip of paper over the alcohol.
Yes.
And so, like, they're trying to do the thing of he's trying to change.
But they also have to show the scene where he's no use to anyone sober, so we gotta drunk him up again.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
Yeah. I think I told Anne, like, this it's a little too close to home.
In the fact of, for me, Spielberg already has an adventure franchise that at least half of them are worth watching. This pales in comparison. Tintin, in terms of the Spielberg canon, isn't as interesting as an adventure as an Indiana Jones film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe in taken separately, it would be fine. To me, there's just nothing memorable of it. If you like this film, I have no cares if you like this film. It's dull to me. It was dull the first time I saw it in theaters. And the really sad part about it is the screenplay is co-written by... Edgar Wright.
It's
Edgar Wright, Joe Cornish, and Stephen Moffat. And yeah. To me, the Moffat elements are much stronger than the Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish elements.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's essentially the director and writer of Attack the Block, the director and writer of Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, and At World's End, and Scott Pilgrim, and upcoming Baby Driver. And Stephen Moffat. Creator or showrunner of the new series of Doctor Who, and it's more of the Stephen Moffat bullcrap, and that's sad. I feel like I might have. Why did you enjoy this film?
I don't know. I had fun.
It's fun. Great. That's about it.
I mean, now I'm disturbed that he's 14 years old, and it changes my whole.
And he's hanging out with a drunk ship captain.
Yeah, I was really hoping he was like 18-ish.
I mean, the film does not specifically give him an age.
Mm-hmm.
14 is just the age he is in the comic. Okay. So, I mean, you can definitely say that he might have been aged up. He's played by Jamie Bell, who is definitely in his 20s, so...
Also, listen, Tintin's just kind of, like, pretty
Tintin's bland!
He's
bland AF! Like, what the crap?
Yeah, so I can project myself onto him. It's perfect. If he had too much character, I can't invest myself into him.
He's like the wannabe Indiana Jones. Like, he doesn't get in too much trouble. It's, like, safe.
I mean, I get it. And that's part of the appeal of him. But also, guys, sidebar. Hi, it's Josh here. I'm whispering so they can't hear me. You guys, I don't like Snowy. He's annoying. He's a dog, and I guess he's got some sort of brain. But Snowy's kind of the worst. In fact, if Snowy wasn't in this movie, I'd be alright with that. Tintin spends half this stupid film just, like, yelling at his dog, Snowy. Like, Snowy, get over here. Snowy, do this. Snowy, do that. I'm like, shut up, Snowy.
Indy.
You spend 90% of your life talking to our cat in the same manner. Charlie, get over here. Charlie, come here. Cuddle with me, Charlie.
Snowy's the worst.
Plus 82, Anne.
Oh, Anne's ahead of India now. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Moving on.
Anyone want to defend Snowy?
No.
That didn't bother me. That's how people talk to their dogs.
I have no ill will towards the dog.
I mean, yeah, Snowy feels like a plot mechanic, but like, he's a fun plot mechanic.
Hashtag no ill will towards the dog.
You're taking hashtags into everything.
Hashtag blessed.
Hashtag blessed indeed. Okay, this next one is my fault that it's so low. Actually, you kind of bring it down a little bit too, but I like seriously bring it down.
I bring it down?
I bring it down the most. Okay. It's Hook. At number 18.
Hey, it's exactly my 18.
It's my 24.
13 for me, so that seems appropriate.
My 24.
Zach, we're really sorry that your number one film... Sorry, it's number one. Is it just number one?
Labyrinth is.
Oh, great. Your top 10 of all-time film is 18 or on our list. Although we're not that sorry.
If you don't watch this movie as a kid, it really has no value. I mean, it's not the worst, but it has several flaws.
I think my opinion on Hook has been said out loud, and I think that you have seen Hook as a child, and that has also been said out loud with Zach's opinion as well, too. And though I do want to hear yours, let's start more with Kylie's, because she just watched it for the first time as an adult.
Yeah, Kylie did not. I thought, like, this was a metaphor. Thought it was going to be like Finding Neverland disc where it's a metaphor.
On the cover, there's literally Dustin Hoffman with a hook.
It's a dream.
Robin Williams is in a leotard.
It's a dream.
Julia Roberts is literally Tinkerbell.
It's a dream.
Bob Hoskins is just dressed in his everyday clothes.
It's true. There's a suicide joke.
Aww. Aww.
Okay, so, I don't know. This movie...
Hook.
I don't know, this movie was kind of hard for me to, like, latch on to, because now as an adult, I am pretty happy as an adult, and while it's like, yes, it would be easier to be a child, I don't have that childlike wonderment of, like, man, growing up, I knew I always just wanted to be a kid. I'm pretty satisfied with where I'm at, and I don't really want to revert to my childish tendencies sometime, but as a whole, I like being an adult.
What about it was grating?
The dialogue, the world, the kids, his son.
Aw, I kind of like his son.
No, his son's the worst.
I'm relatable.
Because you're the worst?
Yep. Me and that kid, we're the worst with our huge noses. That kid has a huge nose, just FYI. Even as a kid, I was like, that kid's got a huge nose, right? And I was like, yeah. I was like, okay, great.
Also, like... Julia Roberts.
Worst part of the movie. For sure.
There's one scene that I enjoy her in, and that's the one where she becomes big-sized, but other than that, she's pretty hard to watch.
And so I don't know, I just don't really care for this movie. A lot of it is this whole fairy tale aspect in this world that they've built. I mean, although watching Robin Williams be like a man-child, that's kind of fun, but... Overall, the message just doesn't hit me in the heart.
So, I think what... Coming at Hook, and I tried to watch it this time as discerning as I could, knowing that I have childhood love for this film. And I think that... For me, So my Letterboxd review starts with this sentence. The film is pure childhood. It has all the flaws of childhood imagination while also having all of its fun. So working with children, what you know about them is everything is big, everything is bright, and everything is over the top. And not everything has to make sense. You know, there's always going to be the thing that comes through passion, or the thing that they're afraid of that is always there for no reason, or the thing that is always driving their love, or that a parent's love is the most important thing to a child. And I think that, a small child, and I think that if you look at this film, and I don't know if this is how Spielberg looked at this film, so this is me positing something onto Hook that might not be there. But if you look at Hook as it's completely told in a child's perspective, mm-hmm. I think that it helps this film because, yes, it has the flaws of it. There's a lot of inconsistencies. There's a lot of gaudy, big, broad, over-the-top stuff. And there's a lot of it that just, you have to go, what in the ever-loving hell is happening? But if you put on your child brain and you just accept that this is a story of an adult trying to remember how to be a child, and then we need to live in a child's world of fantasy and fairies and pirates and adventure, and we need to go back to those logical, illogical fallacies, then this film works. I think it works on those levels. But if we can't look at it through a child's eyes, then it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And looking at it in terms of plot and character and story, it doesn't. The production design is some hot trash. Even though it's some stuff that I am really fond of. That baseball scene just connected home to me, you know? Like, yeah, Peter Pan didn't go to his baseball game, but Hook did. Like, you know? And Rufio...
Hook also is talking about murdering children left and right.
It's fair. Hook's not a good dude. Hook's not a good dude. I understand. And also, I like the character of Rufio. I think that... I shouted Bang Rang a lot and chanted Rufio all the time. And the scene with the food, where he finally sees it, I think is a really magical scene in general. What are you going to say?
Well, that pretty much covers it. It's fun. It's not great, but it's good. I like rewatching it.
I put it real low to begin with, and then I went, I'm just being too hard on it. And I bumped it up a little bit, but it was originally the last one when I saw it.
In any ranking, it's usually in the bottom three. I mean, I think our ranking is really high because of we have at least two people who have childhood views of this film.
Yeah.
And the very common sentiment is, if you watched it as a child, Hook is fun. If you didn't, it's not fun. I think one of the things that, I don't know, maybe you can disagree on this, is Dustin Hoffman, I think, is giving a genuinely good performance. Yeah. I really like what he does as Hook in this film.
I do too.
Great.
He worked. Robin Williams also works in the character that he is.
Yeah.
Like it's not... It's not the performances, I just...
I the premise the, is weird.
The wonderment. Alright. Okay, Anne, this one is your fault. So, Anne, why don't you take it away? What's number 17?
I mean, I Anne, can imagine that it is either...
Nope.
No. Nope.
E.T.
Yep.
Okay. I also rated Minority Report really, really low, so...
E.T. is my number 13.
6!
27.
6!
Why are you yelling in my direction?
Sorry! 6!
27.
Josh, I had it at 13. I know that's a little bit low, but it's at 13.
I can accept a 13. It's in the upper half, and if it doesn't emotionally connect, fine.
I'm also an adult. The childlike sense of wonderment is gone.
You talk about it for a while. I gotta go cuddle my cat.
Come here, Charlie. Come cuddle with me, Charlie.
This movie is terrifying, and I hate it.
So, Anne, this is the movie that set you on to your...
I'm terrified of aliens because of this movie.
Is it just the way that E.T. looks, or is it the fact that
he's... It's not a looks thing, although I find him to be physically disturbing to look at. It is the fact that he nearly kills this child...
I mean, he does become a parasite in this family's home.
Yeah.
Causes them to lie to their mom.
And he makes weird sounds.
This is the movie I realized that Spielberg might have father issues. And I was like, huh, you're trying to bring in a character to help deal with a divorce?
So, not only that, but E.T. is Steven Spielberg's film response to a question asked by Francois Truffaut during the filmmaking of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Francois Truffaut essentially was like, I can't quite remember how the conversation went, but like, how would you look at this through a child's eye? And E.T. was his response. Which I think is a wonderful, beautiful concept. And one of these days I will revisit E.T., but the trauma is still too real.
I thought that this had some cute, heartfelt moments, and I do that ending where he has to say goodbye to E.T., though I knew how it was going to end, I was still like emotional and sentimental about the idea of like letting go of your best or your friends and whatever. And so I was actually very like emotionally attached to it, although there were parts of this where I was like, get to the government! I want the government to come in and ruin things!
I love E.T. E.T. is one of my, like, favorite films growing up as a child. I definitely watched it a lot. But interestingly enough, I hadn't rewatched E.T. since I was a kid. I just somehow, through the course of buying things on DVD, I didn't get it till later in my collection. And you know, it was on Netflix for a little bit, and I just didn't get a chance to get around to it because I thought, I know E.T., I like E.T., and it had faded a little bit in my memory, and I was really glad that I took the time to rewatch it for this rewatch. To me, E.T. is one of his seven masterpieces. I think that it is a brilliant film dealing with what it means to be a child of divorce. And I know that for me, having grown up, and I remember times where my parents were together, and I remember times where they were fighting and their divorce, and then I remember the after times. And so this film hit such a deep emotional impact for me where, you know, when you don't think you can trust your parents anymore because they're always fighting and they're always mad and you want to be somewhere else, anywhere else. You want a friend. You want a friend who you need to take care of because you then feel important and again, and then you can feel like it's less of your fault because you are taking care of something. I get it. Like, E.T. works for me in so many levels. The part of E.T. coming in and being a parasite on their family and the fact that...
Oh my gosh, I was making a joke. I'm not being realistic.
Okay, because I was like... But, like, to me, like, that's a beautiful connection between E.T. and Elliot. And I think that, yes, it awakens the mom into what's actually happening into this world. And you see these kids rallying around this point and needing to really come together and move past the fact. I think what this really is about is it's about letting go. And I love that Spielberg in this film lets E.T. go. He leaves. There's no sequel. There's nothing. He leaves. He didn't stay. This is about letting go and moving on. And this whole story is from that point of view. It's a really gentle, it's a really subtle story. I just think the film is pure magic in what it does and what it says. And there are fun moments from E.T., you know, dressing up and kind of, like, the E.T. dresses up scene where I think he dresses up as, like, a woman. And then I like the scene where he's going to wander around the house with Drew Barrymore and mom's, like, just kind of oblivious to things. I think the relationships between Elliot and his older brother are really strong and really real. The kids on the bikes at the end of the film feel very earned and very justified as they're all trying to run away from the police. I don't know. I just, there's so much about E.T. that I think works on this deep, deep emotional level. And you can tell how personal this film is for him. You can tell what he was trying to deal with. And this is absolutely the film, like Kylie said, where you can, if you haven't known before, he has father issues. And he has issues that he's trying to work out through this. And he also doesn't necessarily have a high point of view on moms as well either, because she's not the best mom. She is doing her best, but she's not the best mom in general. I think the film feels like the 80s. The products that are in there, the house that's in there, that weird-shaped table that they have.
Man, that bothered me for that entire scene. I was like, how many sides does this table have?
I mean, I really also, I love the scene of, you know, you see through E.T. that the main character is really, really growing up. And so I think there's lots of things in there that I really love. And the film is wonderful. I am stuttering through my words because I think it hits me on such an emotional, impactful level. And I have it at 6 because I think that there's some deeper, more culturally relevant and socially impactful things that he talks about in some of his other films, but just as for pure joy and pure magic, you can't really beat E.T. for me.
Nice.
I don't care. He's not gross. He cute.
Yeah, he's kind of gross when he, like, extends his body parts.
Yeah. I had a little E.T. He was cute. I liked him. His finger lit up. Also, the E.T. ride at Universal Hollywood was pretty cool.
You would never catch me dead on that.
No, because we could just take your dead body and fling it onto it. It would have worked. Perfect. Anne is glaring at me.
I hope one day you rewatch E.T.
I like Stranger Things, which is essentially the same story. In a very loose sense.
Yeah, except for that would make 11 E.T., and 11 is a different character.
Right, but I mean, like...
She's the placeholder of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a film that I hope to share with my kids when they exist.
My number 16.
Great. Oh man, that's only number 16? I want to talk about some crap films again.
Duel!
No, it's not crap. I like
that's
Duel.
That's my number 16.
That is my number 16. Oh no, you're the one that didn't make it golden!
I have it at number 12.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Kelly, why do you like Duel? It's clearly 16, but why do you like Duel?
It was quite a fun time. So we were watching this because we only had a small time slot, and it's his shortest film.
Yes!
It's not truly it doesn't have the...
It's not quite Spielbergian in length.
Because it's a TV movie, and we have to... It's literally 90 minutes.
I mean, that is something to bring up, though, that this is a TV movie, but it is his first full-length feature film that he has. It's just not his first theatrically released film, although it did, after Jaws broke big, it was put into theaters as kind of like a money grab.
I think it's a pretty fun and interesting time because this entire thing is based on our anxiety about the idea of passing someone on the highway and making an enemy while driving, and there's no real understanding of why this is happening, but it's just happening to this guy, and you can relate to his actions and what's happening. Now, sometimes I'm like, oh, just pull off, blah, blah, blah. But it just feels exactly what you would do in this situation. You would start kind of freaking out about the whole ordeal. And I think that he builds paranoia and tension really well, because there's a scene where he's in the diner and he's like, he's narrating inside of his head, and like, you're looking around trying to figure out who the truck driver is, and you never actually truly find out. And he gets back into his car and just goes. And then that orange shot, he sneaks in at the very end.
There it is. Orange happens.
The reason I did not rewatch this film, but the reason it is where it is on my list, is I watched it one time when it was on TV with my grandparents when I was like 8 years old, and it has stuck with me. This is a film that I remember watching vividly. Like, I remember most of this film. I remember how I felt when I watched this film. I think about this film a lot, especially when I'm driving. Like, this film stuck with me for a long time. I didn't know what it was, and I think just because of that, like, I remember it being a very excellent film.
And it's so, I mean, this is very similar to the Sugarland Express. It's so simple that, and it's a simple concept that he does very brilliantly.
It's really visceral, too. Like, it's just really kind of guttural, and, like, mm-hmm. fear of this thing. I like that you bring up the point that it's the fear of passing someone on the road, because I think with truckers, a lot of times that we all have anxiety of driving in and around them because they're so much bigger, and you know there's so much, like, there's a higher chance of
death
and mistake. I like this case. So we still have the case from the library. If you don't know what a library is, it is an institution where they keep books and other things that you can check out for free. So it's a cool thing to check out. I know they're kind of new and fanciful, but libraries are fun.
You may have heard of a Reading program.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Over the summer, they have these Reading programs where if you read some books...
That's right. It's in a building. I know it's different. I know it's weird. And there's not a screen. There's words on a page. I like how we're being all high and mighty and fluting, and we got a stupid movie from the library. Like,
they have a great selection.
They have quite an interesting selection. The fact that this was there, because like we were going through and I was requesting the movies, and I see this movie and I was like, I've never heard of this, so it can't be an actual Spielberg film.
Not only do they have this movie, but they have the collector's edition.
Yeah, it has an interview with him.
But if you look at the case of this movie, it looks like it belongs in a dollar store bargain bin where you're like, Steven Spielberg, this isn't, this can't be real. You lying to me, dollar store.
Fear is the driving force.
No, Duel is really interesting. I don't think it, to me, the it doesn't quite work on every level because there's definitely sections of this film where I'm like, okay, now what? Like, I like that it
you just
guessing.
Don't like the snakes. Let's don't be like honest. The
snakes. Stupid snakes.
Oh yeah.
You were literally like there's a semi truck coming after him, and he runs into a snake cage, and like there's snakes on the ground, but the semi truck is still coming after him, and you're like, oh, now there are snakes everywhere.
Literally the scene where like the semi truck drives through the phone booth, and then like the snakes get free. I'm like, oh, the snakes are free.
If you don't know what a phone booth is, it's where Superman used to go to do costume changes.
It's also where Colin Farrell was trapped.
Man, there was a time I really liked that film.
I remember this time.
Oh my gosh, I was like, phone booth is the greatest film ever made.
Great. Stay tuned for our episode on Phone Booth coming soon.
I've not watched that film in a long time, but like, I guess I just like an unknown. I like unknown. Similarly with Duel, I like an unknown force that is just coming after you, and you're not exactly sure what the reason is.
All right. Well, we've missed Colin Farrell's birthday for this for this year. It's on the 31st of May, but next year for Colin Farrell's birthday, Phone Booth it is. Just mark that on your calendars now.
I think the Duel, I mean, it is a, it plays within the idea of the unknown intention that I do enjoy, and so it was a good time.
The only part for me that I wish was tightened up was actually the diner sequence, because although I liked his whole, it like, oh, okay, it could be one of these people, and like his suspicion and paranoia was really nice in that sequence, it drug for me to the point where when he finally confronted somebody, I was like, this is clearly not the guy. You're gonna be in a bad situation here, buddy. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I like Duel. I don't love it. It works really well as a B movie. It has all the kind of like problems of that genre as well too, but I don't know, it's fine. I don't dislike it, but it coming, knowing that Jaws is two films later from him, he does this concept better. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that he gets to do that.
He gets to polish it up.
Yeah.
And I think that it helps that he has a longer screen time and he has a budget.
Yeah. It's worth watching, though. It's really, it's interesting. Yeah, I like it a lot.
There's this one shot of the semi-truck, like, flying off a cliff. And you're like, you get one shot at this. You better make this one count, Speely.
And then, fade to orange.
The beginning.
The beginning of the orange shot.
In case y'all aren't aware, the name of this list is Ducks Watch Together, : Spielberg, The Man in the Orange Glow.
There you go, because he's got one shot almost every film where it fades to orange and then there's a silhouetted character.
This next film actually kind of, the cover of it kind of has that orange and a silhouette, if you can guess what that film is. Number 15 is The Color Purple.
Oh. That's my number 10.
It is my number 19.
15.
And you have the highest. Why don't you take the...
Okay, this film is flawed in that Steven Spielberg seems to be in over his head with this subject matter. That being said, he does pull some excellent performances out of this film, and I think that that is the area in which this film succeeds. Yeah.
I think that there are a lot of great pieces within this, but when I try to put those pieces into a puzzle, the puzzle kind of doesn't fit all the way there.
And I just think that, though that I agree with all those sentences, for me it's hard to really... I mean, it's 2017. I'm a 2017 critic. That is a thing that is true. It's hard for me to look at this film and not kind of see its white male perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that's not well told, but it is a white male's perspective on a African-American female story.
A very sad story that doesn't sound sad when you watch the film.
Sound sad, you mean...
Music-wise.
The score, okay, yeah.
I feel like... And this... So, there's a lot of violence against women within this film, which is actually he later does well, I think. There's the particular scene in Schindler's List where he does show the fear of the dominating mm-hmm. force on women. And I feel like in this film, he just doesn't hit it quite enough. I think that he's holding back
it
a little bit in this film.
Glossed over to play it safe.
Mm-hmm. It which feels is like unfortunate. He wants to tell... What is Whoopi Goldberg's character's name?
Celia.
It feels like he wants to tell Celia's story and her life, mm-hmm. but he doesn't want to go too far into the reason behind it.
And I really, I commend him a lot for trying to make this film, and I would never say, like, bleh about it, but I do think that it doesn't all the way come together. And so having read the book, and again, you shouldn't have to compare it to the book because this should exist on its own thing, I get a much different and better and stronger perspective from the book than I do in this film. And it does come from the fact because Alice Walker has those experiences. And she can tell that more honest story. And she goes a little bit deeper. She kind of punches towards the gut a little bit more than I think Spielberg. I think he really pulls his punches in this. And I think he's doing it out of respect. But
right. And I think he's playing it safe because who else would be allowed to direct this film at this time. There are, even now, there are few and far between female directors with
Ava DuVernay.
Yes, and I think she could pull it off quite well. Selma is an achievement in film. But Steven Spielberg tries to tell this story, and he knows it's an important story, but he plays it too safe.
So I think within that, there is something that Spielberg connected to with The Color Purple that made him... Because he has said, and it is clear, that this is a very personal story to him. And to me, what I think he's trying to do in his allegory is that he gets at and he tries to find universal elements for every story that he's telling. And I think his universal element here that he's getting at is relationships with fathers, because if we're looking through this film as this lens of what it's like to be with an abusive or with a bad father, I think that that's where he sees himself, and that's where he sees that he can tell that story. And what he's not yet, or what he can't deal with, is the masculine point of view on what it does to her. What he does deal with is what he's more interested in, which is the effects of said abusive father. And he feels that there's that connection there. And that's why I think that in this film, Whoopi Goldberg, who surprisingly can act, gives a really amazing performance of this emotionally stunted girl who seems like she never really ages past 14 until she's finally free from her abusive husband, who's actually their age difference enough to be her father. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the more interesting elements of the film. I think that, as you guys have said, that Spielberg is the person who can get this to the screen at this moment, and so it is very progressive. And we had talked a little bit about
the queer identity
within the film, and how that there is a moment where there is a kiss, not only a kiss between two women, but two African-American women, which in 1985 is huge, but it's nothing as compared to what is said in the book.
Mm-hmm. And her attraction to Shug Avery,
yeah,
it feels it didn't feel as very earned, because it's like she comes into the picture and then it's like she's suddenly just like,
to
like
me,
this lady.
It doesn't seem like I never felt that the Cecilia character was attracted to Shug, but she was curious mm-hmm. and was glomming on to somebody who was showing her any form
she
of
kindness.
Yes, she
was attracted
absolutely.
To, yeah, because
she was attracted to her kindness, not mm-hmm. her physical nature.
Yeah.
And is that something that's played in the book, or is that just something that's in the film?
It's played in the book, but that leads into the
physical attraction.
The actual relationship. Yeah, and so it... And I mean, I think that Spielberg doesn't really, I mean, he is a straight white male, and so this is a different perspective from him, and I don't want to be like, bleh, you had the wrong perspective, but I'm not like, not, like, giving you a red X on
this. It's an A for effort, definitely, yeah. And I think that while there's some real tonal issues with this, and this is another film where Spielberg's sentimentality really hurts this film. He looks at everything through this kind of candy-coated sugar thing, and that includes the score, which there's a scene where... There's a couple scenes early in the film where Danny Glover's character of Albert is going in to sexually assault
the sister,
and or Whoopi Goldberg's character herself, the younger version of it. And there's like kind of like this happy like score, and you're like, what is happening? This is whose point of view are you trying to get me to take here? And it does make me question if the characters, and I could be forgetting a scene, but the characters don't ever really question the fact that it's happening.
Well, it makes it pretty clear in the film that being assaulted by an older male is just something that is a part of life for them.
The only counter to it is Sugar Avery's like, no, I enjoy my relationship with Danny Glover. And she's like, you like that? And Sugar Avery's like, I love it. And so, I mean, that's the only... But, I mean, that's also a different relationship, it seems. It's not a violent
So nowhere one. In here is it really said that what's happening is any form of rape or sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, The Color Purple is the fourth highest grossing film of 1985. Which I think is really telling in terms of what Spielberg... I mean, it's a popular story, it's a Pulitzer Prize-winning story, but just getting that Spielberg name attached to it in the 80s, especially coming off of... I mean, let me pull it up here real fast, but the run of films that he's up to before he does this one... So it goes... The three films before this are Raiders, E.T., Temple of Doom, and then The Color Purple. So he's huge. I mean, on top of already having Jaws and Close Encounters in his bag. He's a director that can pull that off. I mean, the only three films that beat it are Back to the Future, Rambo First Blood Part 2, and Rocky 4. You know.
The first Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think
that's... And, I mean, two of those films have strong a fan base for them because they're the second and the fourth within a series, and so...
Yeah. It's two Stallone joints and Back to the Future.
I mean, yeah. Stallone was a popular man in the 80s. Apparently. He had his run. All right. Now, next one is the BFG. I ruined this one.
You ruined this one.
Wait, what is it on our list here?
14.
It's 14 on my list.
It's 14 on Josh's list. It's 15 on mine.
Oh, no!
That's so close.
I ruined everything.
I was like, wait a minute, who has it high? Because I have it right here in the middle. Like, this is right where it goes.
No, like, this is literally where it goes.
Yeah. So perfect to being a golden ranking. Definitive number 14.
So this is the last film that we've seen of the latest.
Most
film
recent.
Of that we've
seen. Most recent at time of recording.
Yes.
Yeah.
That we've seen of Spielberg. And I think that he's trying to revert to the kind of fun and aspect of E.T. is. Because he is telling a story about a human that who makes friends with a non-human entity.
Some sort of magical being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they go on an adventure.
Yeah.
Dealing with life.
I really like the BFG. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a very well-told story. I think that he relies a little... in this point, he's come to this point with CGI in this film where he's building a cartoon world. And therefore, he's allowing the CGI to be a part of the story. And he's blending that mocap animation because the BFG is that same mocap animation with, 5 years of development, put on it for making the BFG himself. But the brilliant thing is you can see Mark Rylance's performance through that animation now.
And I think that it helps that, I mean, most of this is CGI, but we also have the real human girl, and so it does create more of a storybook element rather than...
Yeah, and his worlds feel interactive. You know, you see them here and stuff like that. I think that's really telling and really nice that we finally get to see him tell... We get to see him tell a story from the point of view of a small girl. And I think that it's really interesting. So noting, we had talked in the previous episode about Spielberg having a lack of female leads. And we got to the Sugarland Express last time. We got to The Color Purple this time. And we're going to the BFG right now. But the BFG, and then his most recent film that's coming out is The Papers. And that, I believe, has Meryl Streep set to be his lead in there too. So maybe, with me saying my defense earlier, a little bit of him being more kind of, I think as he'll come around, I'm wondering if in the latter part of his career here, if he's going to start to make more films about women and trying to make them be his more archetypal, moralistic heroes that he uses a lot. So I'm hoping that's something that he's moving towards.
This is a really cute film. I like it a lot. My biggest issue with this movie is Roald Dahl always has an element of creepiness to it. It's a little eerie. It's a little mysterious. It's also fun. And I think that the creepy, eerie element of the book is completely not in this film at all. Which I think is to its detriment. Again, it's a fun story, but it's not scary, and I know that Steven Spielberg did not mean for it to be a scary film at all, but reading the book as a child, I was always, like, kind of scared of the big giants.
I mean, I think that it has an element of danger to it, especially in that opening sequence where he's using his shadow and he kind of kidnaps her off the street, and then any of the introduction of the big
just
giants.
It's not as gritty as I imagine it to be.
Yeah, no, it's not gritty. Yeah, yeah.
At all. And I want, because it's British, because it's Roald Dahl, I want it to be a little gritty, you know?
Right.
And I like the cartoon. It was a made-for-TV movie. And it tells the same exact story from, like, 1979. And I think that cartoon really captures the balance between mystical, magical, and creepy.
And I will say that watching this film on the big screen, I had a more emotional reaction to it. And coming down from that, I definitely was like, okay, this isn't maybe as good as I had thought it to be. But I think that his cinematic qualities are all over this thing, and I feel that the story that he tells with the girl works really well. And there's a scene that a lot of people point to in right beginning the third act, which is right before they go to kind of save the land of giants, where he has dinner with the queen, and it's one of my favorite kind of Spielberg things that he does, where he takes time to show characters and he takes time to show growth, and he knows that at this point, we need to see a relationship built with the queen, so he takes time to do it. And I really like that dinner scene, which is, I know, a lot of people's huge criticism of the film. I mean, yes, there's a giant fart joke at the end of it, but, I mean, all right, that's for children. Like, and that's there. That's a thing that kids do find funny. So, great, not for me, but the development of it and watching the two worlds collide works really well.
This was one that I could, like, get engaged with the mystical elements and the childlike wonder of it, which I'm surprised that this is the one and it wasn't others that I was like, this is the one I connect with. This personal story, this movie really opened my eyes to how grossly American my mind can be, because as soon as he goes to the queen, I'm like, use him for military purposes, you can take over the world, you have, and then I stopped and I was like, ooh, that's my American brain.
Gotta shut that sucker off.
But, I agree with everything that you have all said. I haven't read the Roald Dahl book, so, I mean, I didn't miss the creepiness elements, and I don't really know any about Roald Dahl other than...
I mean, interestingly enough, this film's a huge flop. Like, it comes out in summer, it's got Disney attached to it, it's got Steven Spielberg attached to it, and it makes no money. It's in and out of theaters so very quickly. And
it's because we're too busy seeing The Secret Life of Pets.
Too busy seeing The Secret Life of Pets. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, it made $55 million domestically and $183 million worldwide. So, I mean, Disney barely made its budget back. It was made on a $140 million budget, and it made worldwide $183. So, with marketing money, I'm sure this film is a flop and a loss. But I would be wondering, and it's just like, to me, why? I don't understand what doesn't... Unless what society is saying is that this Spielberg, we've passed him by. Like, maybe Steven Spielberg, though I think one of the great directors of all time and a really formalistic person, he's holding a lot on to classic filmmaking, even with recent stuff like Bridge of Spies, that feels like a film from a different era. It gets a limited release. Like, maybe society has passed by on what Spielberg is doing, and I think this, the BFG, might be that, like, yeah, dude, we're done with what you want to tell us as a society. And I'm really sad by that, because I think he still has more stories to tell, but we just might be done with his cultural relevance in terms of big, broad culture.
Well, I mean, when a lot of his older films come out, they're coming out in the time where there's, like, two movies in theaters, and so you go see the movies that are there. And now there's just such a gross amount of films that are being released. And, I went and saw Bridge of Spies because I was like, this is gonna get nominated for some Oscars. I should go see it and things. And so I think that also has some relevance onto it.
Yeah.
Number 13 is Munich.
That's exactly my 13.
It's my 11.
It's my 14.
Oh. I'm surprised it's that high for you, Anne.
You know, because we just, like, it was the last thing that we watched right before we started this.
Yeah, we turned off the TV and we were like, let's record.
Basically.
I mean, I wasn't home from the vet with Charlie yet.
I think it gets this high because of Eric Bana. I was absolutely surprised by his performance. I did not think that he would be that good. He could ever be that good. But there's this moment where he's talking to his wife on the phone and he hears his daughter and he just breaks down and you feel for him. Like, regardless, the plot's very convoluted. It's a true story, and at times you get a little bit lost, but overall you can keep it together relatively well. I think that's the best scene of the film. Like, you feel for him regardless of what he's doing or where he is in the story.
And I do think that it brings up the moralistic quandary of the political aspects of what's happening in Israel and Palestine today. It's like, you understand where the people who are performing these actions are coming from, but you also have your own inner moral, and you're questioning, like, is what's happening right? And can I get behind these characters?
Yeah. I struggle with Munich because it has a lot of fans, and I think that I respect Munich more than I like Munich.
Mm-hmm.
When I was ranking my list, I kept always, one of my questions was, which one of these would I watch if it was, like, just down to these two and I had to pick one? And there are definitely films below Munich, especially, like, BFG being one of them, that I would pick BFG over. I'd watch the BFG over or watch Munich again, but I see Munich's value, and I guess that's kind of the nicest thing that I can say for it. I think the action sequences are built exquisitely well. They're staged so beautifully, and they're paced so well. He uses this tension so very well to allow you to understand how every bomb works, how every set piece is going to work out. You get to know the characters that they're killing just long enough to care enough whether it works or not works. And Bana is the real center of this film, but I think that Jeffrey Rush is also really amazing in what he does, and I think that he kind of helps provide some more immediate conflict. Because much like everything else in modern warfare, I mean, this isn't really a warfare. It's an espionage spy film. But much like everything else in the modern games of politics and war, everything is a long payoff. Something happens, and then you have to plan strategically to counter it down the road, and then you plan strategically to counter that down the road. And so the immediate payoff of something like a World War II or a war film is not here with this. There's a long-term payoff. And so...
it's espionage-esque in that way.
Yeah, and I think, to me, Spielberg's technical mastery of building tension is more impressive than the political global story that he's trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And that really hurts it for me, is because I can look at it on this technical level and not connect to it emotionally, except for a few scenes with Bana. And I think Bana is genuinely really great in this.
I was very surprised. Yeah. He gets to be called Eric Bana today.
Yeah.
Instead of Eric Bana.
Yeah.
There you go.
You've earned it, buddy.
Well, and I think that you were talking about the tension scene. Like, me and Anne were freaking out over the girl walking back into the house, and we were like, oh, it was so, like, shattering.
Because, like, I can remember specific scenes of this film. I cannot remember why things happen or how they're set up.
It's revenge. It's like, you hit us, yes. We hit you back, you hit us, we hit you back.
Yeah.
There was also a really weird gun in it. And
oh, yeah. It's like the tap gun.
The tap gun. The tapper.
To kill
you
that.
You said there was also a, and I was like, here we go. We're going to get to it. We're going to get to the weirdest scene in this film. Do you know what the weirdest scene? There's also a really weird sex scene in this film.
Oh, God. I have already blocked it from my mind. It was uncomfortable.
It's
when Eric, at the end.
It's at the end.
When he's flashing back.
Oh.
And he's like, what gets Eric Bana's character going?
Thinking about can't have sex without thinking about it, because that, like, has been his life.
Because, yeah.
It's what really drags this film down for me a lot. Mm-hmm. This is the way that you're going to finally show the actual end of the hostages, is through this weirdly graphic sex scene. And
we couldn't tell if it was actually happening or he was fantasizing about it.
About what?
That those flashes back.
So yeah. What those are is...
is it the end of the beginning?
It's the end of the beginning. So you only hear about how the hostage just dies, but you see it in that. And so that's, like, I guess his driving motive. It's just strange.
I mean, I guess that it's there to show that this is what his life has become, and he's so consumed by it that it's the only thing that gets his blood boiling.
I guess. Yeah.
Okay, this next one makes me sad. It's Minority Report at number 12.
Too high. I have it at 23.
I have it at 3!
I have it at 11.
I cannot stand this
film.
So
this would be one of your 7 Spielbergian masterpieces.
Oh my gosh. I don't know what it was about this, but I fell in love with this movie, and I clinged onto it, and I was like, oh my goodness.
Okay, wait. I'm gonna let you finish, but... honestly, I'm the middle of the road, so I want to get the middle of the road in here, and then just, I'm gonna let you two duke it out, because... ding, ding, here we're gonna go.
Do you think Anne and I are actually gonna duke it out?
No, I don't. I think you're gonna have...
Anne, you're wrong!
I think you're gonna have a civil conversation about what's gonna happen, however...
I assume Kelly has a valid opinion on how she feels.
So watching this from the 2017 lens, this movie is about questioning whether we should criminalize people for the actions that they have not committed yet. And, like, the crimes that they've not committed, which is a big question within our own society right now. And I could really see how we are that far away from this future, and it was very interesting and terrifying to see us very close to that future. I also liked Tom Cruise in this performance and Colin Firth, and I think that they both are serviceable.
Feral.
Dang it! I think that they are both very serviceable in what they're doing, and it is easy to watch what they are doing, and I believe their characters and what they're accomplishing. And overall, I just think that it was a very interesting story and a question about how do we have our own real choice and are we of free will or not?
I don't like this film. I don't want to look at Tom Cruise in this film. I don't care about what's happening to Tom Cruise in this film. I like Colin Farrell in this film. Colin Farrell is surprisingly excellent in this film. He is doing what he knows to be right for his character, mm-hmm. as well as Tom Cruise is doing what he thinks to be right for his character. I think Colin Farrell executes it better. Tom Cruise isn't bad in this film. I just don't care.
He gets the job done.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise has the knack of playing characters that are very bland, and it's...
And he makes them work.
And we're able to, like, cling on... Like, we're able to reflect ourselves onto it, and...
I just don't... Yeah, to me, this film is very boring. I don't care for it. I probably won't watch it again. To me, there's a lot of, like, logical and legal loopholes that they seem to make up for this film. Like, I feel they have this whole pre-crime division, which is what all of this is categorized on, and the whole film is the they're trying to make it national, and then, you know, shenanigans abound with Tom Cruise, and I feel like so many problems would have been solved if they didn't have pre-crime. They could have pre-crime, but just charge people with attempted murder.
Mm-hmm.
And send them through the regular legal system.
I mean, that's all fair. Like, if... I imagine that if I thought too hard about it, I could unravel the strings. But what I... Another thing that I really liked about Minority Report was that I thought I had it figured out. Like... Stevie really pulled the wool over my eyes, because I was like, Colin Farrell's gonna be the villain of this, and he just ends up being a foil who's doing what he believes is right and what society has put onto him as being right. And I think that it also just, like, I mean, watching it, I was like, oh, hey, that guy, the guy that he's gonna kill, I was like, that's the guy who kidnapped his son. And it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was much more than that, and I appreciated that. I was taken by surprise, and I was able to go through that kind of, like, whoa, and I think it's set up very well by Spielberg, because a lot of times those surprises, they don't get me, but Stevie.
It's interesting to me, because I did find this movie extremely predictable.
Mm-hmm.
I had only seen it through the moment where Tom Cruise swaps out his eyes, which is disgusting. So I had seen it up to that point, but watching it this time, once he had started digging into the old prisoners and files started being missing, I was like, oh, he's being set up. I didn't necessarily know at that point that it was the head of pre-crime, basically, and I did not necessarily see that the guy he was going to kill wasn't the guy who kidnapped his son, but I knew that that was somehow going to be intertwined with him being set up.
Yeah.
So... You know, it has... I think the film has some interesting ideas, and I get what it's trying to say. I'm not there for it. I don't really care.
I mean, if he catches the ball after it's already started falling, is it really pre-crime?
Just call it attempted murder! Just call it attempted murder, and all of your problems are solved.
This is the problem with this movie,
like,
all right?
They have not killed anyone.
The actual genuine question of this movie is if he stops the ball before or after it's falling. So when does falling begin? And that's the genius.
When does
question.
Murder begin?
Well, okay, so...
I mean, you can look at it scientifically. Falling
I
begins
mean,
when it
just
is affected by gravity.
Doing some basic internet...
So it's before it even starts rolling. So murder happens all the time.
Yeah.
Doing some basic internet research, your thing of saying charge them for attempted murder and charge them for actual murder... The difference legally between attempted murder and actual murder, if convicted on those charges, and again, there's first, second, and third degree of all of those things. The only difference in penalties to them currently in our current legal system is for attempted murder, you cannot be given the death penalty or life without parole. You can, however, be given every other option. So the worst sentence you can get for attempted murder is life in prison with parole.
Potential parole. All right,
so essentially, there's not really a difference in the charges between
so
them.
So it should be attempted murder.
All right,
but
so...
Is there a difference between crimes of passion? Because...
Well, that would be with degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so a first-degree attempted murder charge requires premeditation of a willful act. A second-degree attempted murder is any charge other than that is not premeditated or planned.
So
and
if you show up and...
third-degree murder is an unplanned murder, but is higher than an accident.
Okay.
So essentially, like...
It's a degree above
so the guy that they catch at the beginning.
Yeah, so essentially it's... non-malicious murder. But
well, and I
with
find
attempt.
Myself be like agreeing with Colin Farrell for a majority of this movie. I don't think that we, as Americans, we would ever come to a point in our society where we would have a legal system where you are sent to jail for life for something you didn't actually do. Like, I don't think that that's in American blood.
That is the
blood.
System that is set up in Minority Report.
I know, and I don't buy it because I think at the most, if we came upon something like this, we would charge attempted murder. Because they seem to always catch these people right about to kill. So that's attempted murder.
We also live in a society where there is police brutality, where these, like, people are not doing anything. And it's the laying down the law before they've done anything mm-hmm. wrong. And so I think that this is, yes, beat for beat, this is not our America right now, but I think that the idea and the themes and the actions that are happening are very close to that.
I agree with that.
I appreciated this. And it's kind of like the idea of The Handmaid's Tale, which is like, we're kind of at a point where it's like, how far away are we from this future? That's a similar idea I have with Minority Report. How far away are we? Maybe not the technology for sure.
But even if you take it to a different level, how far away are we from charging people for crimes just for being Muslim?
Mm-hmm.
We're not that far.
Or the severity of the degree for people for possession of weed. You know, people get years for holding a small amount of weed.
So, I mean, the thing being is that, yes, we might not be near a point where we would convict someone for murder before it happens. We would convict them for a different crime. However, I think the idea is very, very strong. And the reason why, for me, this kind of ends up being a 3.5 mishmashy film is I think it goes off the rails a little bit and then writes itself and then goes real off the rails. I don't care for the Peter Stormare section where he's trying to get new eyes. I think Stormare is too big for this film.
I know
it
was building up to that point, but...
Surprise! We've been a Minority Report podcast the whole time!
Yep, never having watched it, I was on board.
And then, to me, after we get to the point where we realize that he's in the room with the guy that he's supposed to kill, and then the reveal of that to the end, where it's actually Max von Sydow's character, it's really plotty and it's not all that interesting. The action elements fail a lot more. Story beat wise. I mean, obviously, production wise, I love the way that this thing is filmed. I think Janusz Kaminski uses a ton of filters to make this look really interesting and really unique. And I love the faded out wash of how this looks and how it's staged and how it's set up and the lighting of the film. And I think in general, it's a very conceptually strong film as to what this version of the future is. And you can also say that in this film, the whole, like, that you see in all the Marvel movies and everything where people are like, just like touching the air and the hand acting of moving the technology.
Man, Tom Cruise
pretty much comes straight from Minority Report.
Hand acting, brilliant.
Brilliant hand acting.
Brilliant.
In the two Tom Cruise Spielberg movies, this is the one that he gives the better performance
mm-hmm,
in.
For sure.
Because I feel like there's a performance here.
Yeah.
And so outside
of something
some,
more than a scared guy running from aliens.
Outside of some story beats that are unsatisfying, and the end just, it's too plotty for me to really get bogged down in. If it would have stayed all about what this society meant, because I think having some sort of like, let's have some sort of societal justice for this system, because it is wrong that they're putting people in jail before they actually commit the crime. Maybe they should be in there being like, whoa, 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 I'm going to talk you down. And, like, I get it to where if you try to talk them down, then the other person's life is in danger still. But I don't know. There seems to be a little flaw in their hitch. Mm-hmm.
But this is also a society where they are brought to believe that this is the inevitable truth.
Well,
what the precog see is inexorably the absolute truth.
The other factor of that is this is not in all of American society. This is
it's just in
DC. Washington, D.C.,
yeah,
where it's a test kind of thing.
And, like, I mean, the last third of the movie, we get to focus on Agatha's character and how it's also her trying to escape her life. And I think that that's also an empowering story for the female character.
Yeah,
and how she's no longer being controlled by a government.
But I feel like I don't know anything about Agatha.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't...
Outside of her circumstance of birth, not really.
Well, I don't think she has a personality other than her wanting to escape. I think that
she's experimented on.
I think that she's so far into this government thing is that she doesn't... That the government has washed away her personality because we hear that they're just constantly drugged. And so she is just starting to develop out of that, and so it makes sense that she isn't quite a person because she's trying to become one.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could have seen that then. And I know that would make this even longer, but I mean, maybe to me, it would be more beneficial for this film to cut some of the stuff about him getting new eyes. Just figure out a quicker solution.
Contacts!
At that point, they've gotta have contacts.
I mean, I get that you want to have that cool sequence where the little spider things go up into the bathtub, and like that's a really fun tension build sequence. But give her more then. Mm-hmm. Let me see her discovering her personality. And so that way when she's there at the end, I feel more, there's more stakes in
her
character.
There's more satisfaction.
And I want to see more of what you're talking about, but I just don't quite think it's there.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, she does give us one of the greatest lines in cinema history. He runs just like his father. Tom Cruise running.
I'm really glad. There are a couple of lines that are like poking at Tom Cruise in here, because he walks in the gap and like the thing's like, how are those black tank tops treating you, Mr. Bibba? And I'm like, oh, Tom Cruise. He has guns in this. Like, he has like the literal arms. And I'm just like, oh my goodness.
You feel like Speedy Babe's like, I got it. I'm gonna troll good old Tommy Cruise here.
But I have the real, this is the most important question.
All right.
So this comes out in 2002, right?
Great.
Do we get the best conveyor belt machinery action sequence in this film of 2002 or in Clone Wars?
This film
for sure.
I just imagine Speely on the phone being like,
Speely babes like, hey, Georgia Porgy,
I have this great like thing that's happening in my Minority Report. And then like
George is like, I can do that too.
Reshoots, because that's added later on, and so it is very plausible in
George
my head.
Is like, hey,
I also could add a conveyor belt scene.
3PO's made of different pieces.
Robot factory.
Great.
I think that takes us to the end of this section.
One more.
We gotta get to 11.
Gotta get to 11.
Okay.
Catch me if you can.
Hey, there it is.
I can't catch him. I give up. This is my number 17.
12?
6.
Oh, there you go. One of Spielberg's 7 masterpieces for Anne.
No.
I like how just in my brain I was like, no, it's guaranteed he has 7 masterpieces.
The 7 wonders of Spielberg.
The 7 wonders of Spielberg.
It's different for everyone. Some people have AI in that.
Some people do.
A lot of people do, unfortunately.
Yeah, if you search on Letterboxd Spielberg.
Oh my god,
break,
so many good reviews on AI.
We just didn't get it.
No.
We were not smart enough.
And you're the one that likes Catch Me If You Can. And
I
you
do.
Were really pining for us to watch this.
This whole time, that was my number one pick, and we finally watched it yesterday. I love this movie. I think that this is one of my favorite Leonardo DiCaprio movies. I think Tom Hanks always does a solid job, as he continues to do.
Yeah, that's Gigolo Jane. He meets with her at the beginning.
No, the score, Kylie!
Too high.
Yeah, I know.
People like it less. Surprising.
AI has a 73. I've just discovered this.
It's fresh.
I'm sorry. Keep talking about it.
Anyways, I really like Catch Me If You Can. I like the 60s elements that are strong throughout this film. I like the idea of this kid who's just great at smooth talking. But I also think Spielberg does a good job of not glorifying the story of Frank Abagnale. He tells it very honestly, and there's a really good cat and mouse chase relationship between the police detective and Frank Abagnale throughout the film.
It's real hard for me to get behind that main character and to watch him. I get very, I don't know, angry at the world that this happened.
He does repay his debt to society by catching future bank frauders.
He gets off too
which
easily.
Which I think is probably the lamest ending to a movie, even though it is what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I think the Leonardo DiCaprio is amazing in this, because he plays a very believable, like,
16-year-old.
He does an amazing range. Like, he's 16 and you're like, yeah, he's a kid. And then he moves forward and you're like, yeah, he's an adult.
And I think that his performance is really good. I think that Tom Hanks is really good. But it was harder for me to want to watch this character's story because I'm angry.
You can let it go, Kylie.
I can't!
He didn't do anything to hurt you. He didn't hurt anybody. He just stole fake money.
Little did you know, she's actually Frank Abagnale's son! Pull off the mask and father issues. It'd be a real appropriate reveal for a Spielberg.
He does deal with divorce in this film. He runs away from home at like 15, 16.
He becomes a pilot.
He becomes an airline pilot.
Cool.
Quote, unquote.
You said pilot. I heard pirate. I was like, yarr!
I mean, he's stealing those plane rides, so essentially.
Josh, what do you think of this movie?
I really, really, really want to like this movie more than I do. I don't dislike it. I think Hanks and DiCaprio are fantastic. And again, I think that there is some really good filmmaking going on. I think he even has a change of pace here. It still feels Spielbergian, but there's a change of pace in some of his quickness and quippiness. And the way that that is told with this cat and mouse chase, there's just something kind of cold about it. And I know that to me, and the film is, it's melancholic, but it's not cold. And so there is something about it for me that's just coming off as like, I don't know, man. Why? What's happening? And I can follow the story easy enough, and
there's really just, not that much to it.
No, there's not. It's not confusing, or it's not hard, or it's not anything like that. It's just, it's rough in that sense of I feel like I'm being lied to by the character the whole time, because I am being lied to by the character for the whole time. So it's hard for me to really connect to this character when I think that I'm dealing with a fraud. And so while I see the performances and I like the performances, and somehow Christopher Walken is the person that ends up with the Oscar nomination from this film, which I'm like, what the?
For telling one story about a mouse that churns story. Cream into butter.
There you go. Christopher Walken's not bad in this film, but if you're going to give somebody
He's middling.
If you're going to give someone a supporting nod in this performance, give it to Tom Hanks, because that is an amazing turn. I just think that it doesn't quite fully come together in a lot of satisfying ways. And I think this to me is a definition of one of those films where the sum doesn't quite add up to the total of the parts. It's not bad. It's good. It's enjoyable, but I don't know. It's light Spielbergian flair, and I think that's not bad. It's better than most people would make. And if this movie's on, I'm not going to turn it off. So, there's that.
Excellent.
I really love the scene at Christmas where... that was not specific.
Which one?
I love the scene where they finally kind of come to head and when he's, like, in Paris with all the money and he's like, it's Christmas, Frank! I always seem to be... it's Christmas! I always seem to be meeting you on Christmas! And he's like, put your shirt on, Frank. You're under arrest. I enjoy that scene. That's a good scene.
Well,
he tricks the trickster.
That were our thoughts on number 20-11.
Those were our thoughts?
Nope, that was.
Kylie, for a long time, you corrected my grammar.
I call it correct writing grammar, because we speak differently than we write. And so when we speak, we're allowed to have more off-putting grammar than when we write.
I still don't think that were our thoughts is a sentence that is correct, even considering colloquialism.
Our thoughts are finished on 11 through 20.
Couldn't they be finalized?
So if you want to come in contact with us, you can do so in many different places.
At Friend of a Friend Podcast, which is our name on Facebook. You can also do it on our website at friendoffriendpodcast.squarespace.com. You can get a hold of us on Twitter at...
FOAF_podcasts.
Is not our current Twitter.
Oh. Sorry.
Go ahead there, Josh.
It's yours.
DWT Podcast?
DWT _podcast.
YouTube.
Ducks Watch Together.
Tumblr.
Ducks. TRBACT, Kylie Galashurin, and...
No, that's Letterboxd.
Sure. What are...
Tumblr.
You did Letterboxd. You're at Tumblr.
Ducks Watch Together.
Letterboxd.
Kylie Galashurin, TRBACT, and... M. Archer.
And finally, most importantly, you can get a hold of us on iTunes, where you can answer our question of the week, which was, which is the most middling Spielberg? Hey, Kylie, what was our 15?
Color Purple.
Yep, we say that Color Purple is the most middlest Spielberg that there is. You tell us if we're right or wrong. And thank you so much for listening. You can leave us 5-star reviews there, as well as subscribe and do all kinds of fun things. We appreciate any sort of thing done on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening. I've been Josh.
I'm Kylie.
And I'm Ian.
Quack, 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 quack,